Amen. After the joy of Easter, and wasn't last weekend just a phenomenal weekend to be together? It was great, wasn't it? After the joy of Easter, we steer back into the verses where we were sitting a couple of weeks ago, and we jump back into the wedding at Cana in John chapter 2. And as you turn there, let me just set the scene. As a church, we believe that God is calling us to steward glory. And so we're spending some time in scriptures that teach us about moments of glory and teach us about what God does within those moments. Previously, we spent some time around the burning bush in Exodus 3, learning about the moment of glory that took place there. And now we step into John chapter 2 to learn about moments of glory, but from an entirely different perspective. Let's read the passage together. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned to wine. He did not realize where it had come from, although the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till last." What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. After this, he went down to Capernaum and stayed with his mother and brothers for a few days. Let's recap super quick. The verse that we use as a lens to interpret this passage is verse 11, where it says, what Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. According to John, this wedding feast in Cana of Galilee was the venue for a display of glory. And certainly as we looked at it the last time we gathered together around these verses, we recognized that some of the components, in fact, many of the components that we were able to draw out from the moment of glory in Exodus 3 were those that we could find in this moment of glory in John chapter 2. But our big focus that we spent in this passage was how John recorded for us that this wedding was one in which we can see a transition from presence to glory. At the start of the passage, John tells us specifically that Jesus was present, that he was invited to be there. And then at the end of the passage, we're told that Jesus' glory was revealed. This wedding moved from hosting the presence of Jesus to hosting a revelation of his glory. And we spent a considerable period of time looking at, is that scriptural to even talk like that, to even think like that? And we examined passages that we saw moments of God's presence transitioning to glory. And as well as that, we called out two main components that were shift moments that saw this transition from presence to glory, which were Mary's intercession and her faith. Now, don't worry, we're not going to spend this time together re-preaching the sermon from a few weeks ago. But we jump into the passage and we call out some important things. And this does feel just a little bit like calling out, prophesying almost some of the things that we're going to begin to see happen. And the verses that we turn to and focus on today are verses 5 to 10. His mother Mary said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He didn't realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much drink. But you have saved the best till now." As we mentioned before, there is much about this passage that feels very behind the scenes. We have this end result of this miracle being enjoyed by the master of the banquet and by the wedding guests. But by the way that John has written this account, it would seem that the guests and the master of the banquet are all completely oblivious as to where this splendid wine came from. There are no recorded pronouncements about the miracle wine. There is no announcement about Jesus and about what Jesus has done. So when we read this at face value, it would seem that those present know nothing about the water turning to wine shenanigans that has taken place backstage. They know nothing about this moment of glory, but yet they enjoy and experience the fruit of this moment. And this really does seem a little bit at odds with everything that we've been talking about so far. In the Exodus 3 moment of glory, we have this sandals off, hiding the face, holy ground, awe-filled moment with a supernatural manifestation. But here in John chapter 2, we have a feast, a celebration, something quite ordinary and everyday, but yet a categorized moment of glory nonetheless. And I think there's something quite significant in this. Locked up within the ordinary and the everyday is a display of glory. This is a wedding, yet this is a significant moment that gathers people together to celebrate something special, but this in itself is not unique. Weddings happened week in and week out all across Galilee and beyond, and if you think about it, when you get an invitation to a wedding, getting that invitation is special, it's meaningful. The people involved, the structure of things, the shape of what takes place within the wedding are the components that are unique, but a wedding itself is not unique. People get married all the time. I bet that right now somebody somewhere in Glasgow is getting married even as we speak. Weddings are this unusual thing where it's ordinary but extraordinary at the same time. A wedding is, and stick with me with this, a wedding is a special, regular, irregular occurrence. Regular in that marriage is an important aspect of our society, and it's normal and it's regular for people to get married, but yet it's irregular in that we don't spend every day or every week or even every month attending weddings, unless you live in the Peyton household this year, that might be quite different, but we don't spend every week, every day, every month attending weddings. When they happen, they are special memory-making moments that we cherish and enjoy. And I wonder if there's meaning in this. This wedding became a venue for a display of glory. Jesus has been present at this wedding. Jesus has been present amongst people involved in the affairs of their life is not irregular. That's quite regular for him. When we look through the Gospels, we see that Jesus regularly accepted invitations to come for dinner. He regularly sat down at dinner tables. He turned up at parties and events. He spent time with people. That was regular for him. And if we bring it into our current day context, Jesus has been present amongst his people. Jesus has been found when his people come together. Jesus walking amongst his lampstands, being present and active amongst his church. That isn't irregular, that's regular. And that's why we say as a church that the presence of God is our priority. We believe, we recognize that God loves to presence himself amongst his people, and we structure and we gather in such a way that we make room for that, we explore that, and we follow him and what he does. So Jesus being present at this wedding was not irregular or extraordinary, but the display of glory very much was. Water turning to wine, that's not regular or ordinary, that's irregular and extraordinary. Wine at a wedding, ordinary, regular, custom, particularly at a Scottish wedding. Wine that instantaneously, supernaturally comes from water, well, that's extraordinary. That's very irregular, even at a Scottish wedding. We are very good at turning wine to water, but we're not so good at doing it the other way around. That's an in-house joke from the bothy this week. Moments in God's glory is just like an invitation to a wedding. It is to step into something very unique and special, yet regular and ordinary. Regular and ordinary, Because God chooses to presence himself amongst his people. He chooses his church, a regular but irregular component of life, to host his glory. God coming amongst his people isn't unusual, and we've become accustomed to finding his presence amongst us whenever we gather. However, hosting glory is to add an extraordinary dimension to that. Glory is when God begins to do that which is special and unique, that which we cherish and enjoy, that which forms memories and brings change and transformation. It is when, if you excuse the clunky language, it's when the ordinary experience and the ordinary level of God's presence becomes extraordinary. And he begins to do amazing things. And a further reason why moments of glory are unique and special, but yet regular and ordinary, is because these moments, when God breaks in and we begin to experience something of his glory, these are but a glimpse of what is to come. When our life on earth is over and we step into our forever, our eternal, regular, our heavenly, ordinary, when we dwell in the glory of God, which interestingly will take place with the wedding of the Lamb. I love the fact that the first ever display of the glory of Jesus was at a wedding. The symbolism here is just brilliant. Folks, one day when our time as we know it is over, we will take part in the wedding of the Lamb and we will spend our eternity living in the glory of Jesus, where there will be no night, but the Lamb will be our light. We will live in his glory. And how amazing is it that God chooses to give us glimpses of that reality? That he chooses to give us a taste of that by releasing his glory upon the church, by bringing his people into special, regular, irregular occurrences and encounters with himself. And you know, in many senses, this wedding scene is a brilliant example. It's a brilliant picture of glory being found amongst his people and amongst his church. The very behind-the-scenes nature of this suggests that. If we take a bird's-eye view on this moment at the wedding, we notice some interesting things. Our attention almost straight away is drawn to two groups. There is a group of people who witness this display of glory, and there's a group of those who don't. There's a group of people who receive a revelation of Jesus, a unique knowledge of him. And then there's those that don't. There are those that are aware of glory, and there's those that aren't. There's those that are instrumental in glory, and there's those that aren't involved at all. There are two very distinct groups within this miracle and within this wedding. Two groups, almost, if you excuse the analogy, on either side of the curtain. Those who are behind the curtain and behind the scenes, and those who are out front in the midst of the festivities. We have the servants and the disciples in one group, and we have the guests in the other. Two groups. But both experience glory. And they experience glory from two entirely different perspectives. And their perspective and experience of glory was determined by their position. One group were servants of Jesus. The other group was just hanging around him. To the guests at the wedding, Jesus was just another guest, just another person celebrating the wedding with them. They were hanging around him in his company. But to those that witnessed the miracle and therefore witnessed the display of glory, well, they were those who were serving his will and agenda, who were intentionally journeying with him and learning from him. And the distinction between these two groups is their proximity to Jesus. Those behind the scenes are almost painted for us as being intimate with Jesus. They are behind the curtain, as it were. They're in the intimate setting of the backstage. They're hearing his voice, being guided by his instruction, obeying his command, almost rubbing shoulders with him. Whereas everyone else is partying on oblivious. They're not so much intimate with Jesus, but in the vicinity of Jesus. Both groups experience glory, but both groups experience them from very different perspectives that are determined by their proximity to Jesus. Church, if we're called to steward glory, then we must seek proximity to Jesus. We must strive for intimacy with him, to come close to him. But more than that, we must use our proximity to him to serve him. Do you know, often in church world, the rhetoric is all about, you know, get sin out, get holy, come clean, be delivered, be set free, pray and fast your life away, get as close as you can. And none of those messages are wrong. God responds to that stuff. If we draw near to him, he draws near to us. But the bigger challenge is what we do when we get there. We need to use our proximity to him to serve him. And in this stunning miracle right at the outset of Jesus' ministry, there is this display of glory. And those who have the most impactful experience of this aren't actually the disciples, but are those that are classed as the servants. And they see this from all angles. They are involved in the moment of glory from all angles. And those that we learn from in this moment then has to be those that are classed as servants. And again, I beat a bit of a drum. I'm sorry. I have my drums and I like to beat them. But notice, we don't know these servants' names. We don't know anything about these people. They are nameless and faceless, but yet they are pivotal in this manifestation of glory. Church, we must learn to be a nameless, faceless people if we're going to steward glory. We have to die to our own glory before we can ever steward his. Let's agree as a church, Glasgow Elam, to never seek glory for Glasgow Elam, but to only ever seek his glory. Amen? And I know we've said this before, but we keep on coming back to it, because this does see a shift in a number of ways that might seem insignificant, but actually are huge. Like, for example, let's agree, church, to never shout about numbers outside these four walls. Let's celebrate in-house that stuff. Let's celebrate in-house what God is doing and call it out in order to recognize the growth that he's bringing and to thank him for what he's doing amongst us. But let's agree that numbers and accolades and ministry boasts will never feature in social media posts. That wasn't intended to rhyme, but it did. We live in a social media world, and that social media is a window into our lives and a window into our church, and we use social media to provide that window and to allow that glimpse of what it is that God is doing. But let's commit that the way that we talk about church outside these four walls does not involve numbers and boasting and ministry accolades. Let's agree to grow in God outside the spotlight, just to be thankful for what he's doing and to only ever spotlight him. Like last Sunday, we had a record attendance of people in the building. We ran out of seats. We're pulling seats from all over the place. We baptized. It is the most number of people I've ever been involved in baptizing. And I know it's easy to put numbers and stuff on social media, and there was loads of posts that did that. But when folks see that stuff, they begin to think, oh, wow, there's loads of people getting baptized at that church. Oh, that church is really growing. That church is doing amazing things. And the spotlight goes in the wrong place. It goes on the church and not on God. Could we agree to not do that? And by that, I don't mean like the social media posts that the church puts out, but that whenever we talk about the church outside these four walls, we're careful to only ever spotlight him. When we begin to look at the role of the servants in this miracle, what strikes me is the preparation that needs to be done for this display of glory. We don't often tend to think of it this way, as we tend to read this through the instantaneous lens that we've come to know with the miraculous. The man arrived blind and he left seeing. The person came deaf and instantly they could hear. The man was carried in his mat. He jumped to his feet and he left carrying his mat. There is an instantaneous dimension to Jesus' miracles. But this one in John 2 is quite different because there's preparation that has to take place. We don't think of this when we read the water turning to wine. We read it almost as an alakazam and the water turned to wine quicker than you could say buckfast. But wow, jokes are going well. In fact, our focus always tends to be on the supernatural moment and not really on the preparation that took place for this. Think about this. The passage tells us, nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said, fill them with water, and they filled them to the brim. The preparation for this miracle, and therefore the preparation for this display of glory, it involved hard work. The servants were told to fill six stone water jars. We're told they're stone. This could have just been read as six water jars. But it's almost as though this detail's put in to paint the picture for us that these jars are big and they are heavy, and we don't know whether they carried the jars to fill them with water or whether they filled them up with smaller buckets and smaller jars. It's unknown to us. But what is known to us is that each jar contained 20 to 30 gallons of water, which means this would have taken time. It would have taken time and it would have taken effort to fill these jars and to fill them to the brim and to do so six times over. 180 gallons of water drawn and carried by these servants. This was no easy shift, and this was certainly not a quick job. The servants had to put in graft. They had to work to facilitate this manifestation of glory. And only once the preparations were complete does Jesus perform the miracle and reveal his glory. This begins to shift our understanding a little bit. We often have the idea that manifestations of God are these suddenly moments, when suddenly there comes an influx of the Spirit. Suddenly something breaks and there's a move of God and revival happens and there's glory everywhere and everything's all wonderful. And reality is, when God moves significantly, it is always on his terms. The timing of it, the shape of it, the dimension of it, it's all about him. And to that extent, it can feel very suddenly. However, there is rarely a suddenly inbreaking of God without a steady, progressive, preparatory period where God makes a people ready, where he does a deep work within hearts and souls, when he shifts things about to bring alignment. Stewarding glory is hard work. And I think there's a sense in which we need to understand what we're being called into here. The preparatory stage can involve graft and it can involve determination. It can be difficult and uncomfortable. It can involve time and effort. And only once the preparatory work is done does God unleash the miracle and reveal his glory. I'd like to suggest that the past few years have been part of that preparatory season and that we're still in that season right now. And I'm sure you'll agree, it's not been an easy shift. And at times, it's been a bit hard work. The journey has not been without blood, sweat, and tears, and it most certainly has not been easy. We've journeyed with mission and vision and unpacked those things together. We've been through the agonizing process of God beginning to shift our focus from structure to culture, and he's begun to do a deep work in the very roots of the church to shift us into fruitfulness. We've had to deal with some spiritual stuff at the heart of the church, and the pruning process has been quite painful. The lining of the church has been hard work. And we've journeyed through very significant moments of change, upheaval, and what has felt like brass heavens as well as open heavens. There's been great times, but there's also been some not so great times. Because stewarding glory is hard work. The breaking in, revealing glory moment, that's all God. We can't manufacture that. We cannot manipulate that. The glory stuff is all on God. But the preparatory stuff is on us. How do we know what we've to prepare for? How do we know how we have to prepare? How do we know what is involved? Well, verse 5 records Mary saying to the servants, Do whatever he tells you. The task of the servants was to follow the voice of Jesus. And it seems quite simplistic, but that we saw a shift from presence to glory was the servants beginning to follow the voice of Jesus. It was when the workers chose to align with him and follow his instruction and obey him. Now, I'm not sure who Mary was in relation to those getting married. Some reckon there must have been a family connection, first of all, for her to be concerned about the wine drought and the impact that that would have on the party, but also, secondly, for her to be in any place to give any kind of command to a servant and for them to heed it. There could have been a family connection. But you would think that if there was, that vital detail would be recorded by John, because Jesus attending a family wedding, that opens up a whole new reading and interpretation of this passage. Now, it could have been. But if we read it at face value, it would seem that the servants chose to do what Jesus told them. And that's important. Jesus hadn't hired them. They weren't his servants. He who pays the piper calls the tune and all that chat. So these guys weren't hired by him. They weren't his servants. He wasn't even the master of the banquet. But when he gave instruction, they were willing to follow it. And this small step was what saw them move from being servants at a feast to stewards of glory. Their actions stewarded glory. From start to finish, this manifestation of glory was stewarded by them. They filled the jars with water. They drew the wine from the water. They carried the wine into the banquet. They stewarded glory. And it might sound a bit crass, but Glasgow Elam, I think we have a choice as a people to either serve a feast or steward glory. What do I mean by that? I mean that we can come together each week, have great sounding worship, bust out a praise move or two, throw a party together, put on a good show, and host and serve the festivities each week. And let's face it, it takes all of us to serve the festivities here. From the welcome to the worship to the AV to the tea and coffee to the kids and the youth, even to the dynamic in the room. It would be a pretty lousy party to come to if there was only a few of us in this massive room and if only a few of us took part in what was going on. We can come together and we can serve this feast together. And don't get me wrong, it is a feast. We will be fed from the word. We will grow together in discipleship through our hubs. And in worship, we will have a great time in the presence of Jesus, just like the guests at the wedding did, just like those in the vicinity of Jesus did, hanging out with him, having a great time. We can serve the feast, or we can steward glory. And stewarding glory involves a lot of behind-the-scenes work. It involves this intentional journey from being in the vicinity of Jesus to beginning to be intimate with Jesus. It involves the choice to align with him, to follow him, to obey him. It involves hard work and time and effort. It involves graft. And it involves us adopting serving as our stance, making the decision and the commitment to serve Jesus and to serve his agenda and not our own. These guys could have said, I'm not wasting time filling these water jars up, Jesus. I've got glasses to wash and hors d'oeuvres to serve. I've got a kitchen to clean and floors to mop. If you want these water jars filled, fill them yourself, pal. Or even better, why don't you get your cronies that are hanging there beside you, your pals, why don't you get them to fill them up? But they didn't. They chose not to serve their own agenda, but that of Christ. Folks, I get that we all have our own thoughts, opinions, and ideas as to what church should look like, what service content should be, what direction we should be going in, what the church should be putting its hand to, what ministry it should be providing, and the things that we should be doing. And those thoughts, ideas, and opinions are not without merit, and they're not invalid. But a key to stewarding glory is to lay aside our own agendas and commit to serving his, regardless of how left field it might seem at times. What does that look like? How do we do that? Well, we take advice from Mary. It involves us doing whatever he tells us, but doing it as nameless, faceless servants. not seeking profit or gain or to be platformed or to be spotlighted by what he tells us to do, not seeking recognition or to build a ministry, not grabbing a megaphone or a social media platform and announcing to the world, this is what he's told us, this is how he's using us, this is what he's doing through us, but rather taking service as our stance and stewarding as our posture and quietly and willingly serving the voice of Jesus as though it is the greatest privilege in life, because actually it 100% is. There are two steps to following and serving his voice. They're quite basic, but they are huge. Mary says to the servants, do whatever he tells you. Mary actually gives the servants two sets of instructions here. She tells them to do two things. The first is this. She says, listen. Listen to what he tells you. Listen to what he says. Listen to his voice. And the second is do. Do what he tells you. They're to listen to what he tells them. They've not just to listen to a lecture on how water can be turned to wine. They've not to listen to a step-by-step guide on manifesting glory. They are to do what he says. Jesus could have told them in one of his famous stories how he was going to display glory. It would have been called the parable of the magic grape. He could have preached to them. He could have prophesied to them what he was about to do. He could have just told them what he was doing as he himself did it. But he didn't do any of that. He involved them in his display of glory, and he used them in this manifestation of his power and his reality, which means that they had to listen, but they also had to do. And these are two very basic steps, listening and doing. But both of these steps are far from easy. Some of us struggle to hear the voice of God, to know for sure, to be sure that we are hearing him, to discern his heart, to cut through the many noises within us and the many voices around us, to hear him. And we're like, did he say that? Did I hear that? Am I right? Am I making this up? Is this his voice? Is it just a thought? Whereas some of us don't really struggle with the revelation part. It's more putting action to the revelation. Because sometimes we can get so caught up in the hearing part that we begin to seek revelation after revelation. That's amazing what you just revealed to me. Could I have some more? Let's get some more of this really amazing revelation. And sadly, the latest prophetic trend in Christendom has begun to raise up revelation junkies that just want the next hit and the next fix of prophetic strategy, but aren't so great and interested in saying, what is God saying? And seeing as he said it to us, how can we steward this and put it into action and bring it to life? Now, equally in churches, we are very guilty of structuring everything around sermons, where the sermon is the focal point and is the main section of the service. And we've got to make sure that we keep everything word-focused and on the right path. And hey, I'm all for that. Could almost say I made a career out of that. But actually, that which moves us from servants at a feast to stewarding glory is being able to hold in tandem listening and doing. Where we serve Jesus with our everything by listening for his voice through the prophetic, through the preaching of the word, through the gifts, and then being a people who embody it, live it, serve it, and do it. And this, in some senses, is the heart behind Hubs. How do we take a sermon from a moment in a service and take it into a lifestyle of discipleship? How do we take it from being a moment on a Sunday morning into a milestone in our spiritual journey and allow it to shape us and to learn from the word together and apply his word to our lives? But more than just this being a personal individual thing, we have to let this shape our approach as a church. That as a gathered people, we listen and do as well as do and listen. Because there's both sides to the coin, isn't there? We can get so caught up in running events and ministries and having a full calendar that sometimes we don't actually listen to what God is asking us to do because we're so busy doing the stuff. We don't have room for him to add something else to the list because we're so busy doing stuff for him that we think we should be doing for him that we don't actually listen to hear what he wants us to do for him. And you know, there's much that God has been speaking to us about as a church. If you go back over the journey that we've been on over the last few years since COVID, he's been speaking about culture, he's been speaking about humility, he's been speaking about fruitfulness, about our worship postures, our worship approaches, he's been speaking about our community and the needs within it. But we have to be willing to not just hear that, but do. Because when we adopt such a stance, we move from serving festivities to being a people that steward something significant of God in our time and in our generation. These servants listened to Jesus. They partnered with his activity. We must listen to Jesus and partner with his activity so that we can steward glory in our time, in our generation, and in our city. You know, I can't help but wonder what was going through the servants' minds when they undertook this task. Jesus told them to fill the stone jars with water, and they got to work to do it without any knowledge of the end result. That's a challenge. Because when we're asked to do something, we're kind of like, okay, I want to know why I'm doing it. I want to know what the outcome is going to be. I want to know what the measurable objectives are. How can we know that we've achieved what we've been asked? I need to know what the outcome is. Whereas these guys just blindly served with no knowledge of what the end result was going to be. John tells us that these jars were those that were used in ceremonial washing. Did the servants think that the rabbi was going to lead the guests at the party in an act of cleansing? Did they think they were preparing for cleansing at a wedding? I mean, I know the wine has run out, but a way to turn a party on its head. To move from celebrations to cleansing rituals? Did they think that filling jars that would normally be used in a cleansing ritual, did they think that the request was a bit out of place given the context? Do you know there are times when God speaks and he doesn't always give us the full picture. He gives us a command, he gives us an instruction, a task, and we have no idea what the end result is going to be or how it's all going to pan out. But what he's looking for us to do is to step out in obedience to his voice. To serve his will and agenda over our own. What we don't read here is Jesus issuing this command to fill the water jars and the servants demanding to know the reason why. We don't hear them objecting to filling the jars or suggesting a better approach. Again, if I'd been the one directing this miracle, it was his first one, Jesus, he could have done me a bit of a hand. If I'd been the one directing this, then I would have had the water jars already filled, and Jesus just walks into the already filled water jars and go, Kazam, buck fast for everybody. Let's get it out. Let's keep this party going. That would have been an amazing way to do it. He's using the stuff that's already in place. He's displaying his glory brilliantly. But we don't hear them coming and suggesting a better way of doing this. Okay, Jesus, you're going to turn this into wine. How about we fill one jar first? And then when it's nearly done, we'll go and get another one and you can do the trick again. And then when it's nearly done, we can get another one and we'll do a buckfast production line. They don't come and object. They don't come and make suggestions as to a better approach. They just did what he asked. Sometimes the command and call of God can seem out of place given the current context. And sometimes in our human desire to fully process, know, and understand everything, we can miss out on the joy that is found by simply stepping out in obedience with God, partnering with him, and just seeing where the adventure takes us. Let me ask a question. It's one I've been challenged with myself. When was the last time you went on an adventure with God? When was the last time you stepped out in obedience to his voice with no knowledge of what was coming next, where it would take you, but just got on board for the adventure and allowed God to do exceedingly and abundantly more than you could ever ask or imagine? You know, we don't know from this passage at which point the water turned to wine. We don't know if it was when the water was being poured into the jar. We don't know if it was when the jars were full. We don't know if it was when the cup was put in and it pulled out wine. I guess only the servants knew the answer to that. They witnessed the glory of water turning to wine. It was before their eyes. It was at their hands that this miracle took place. It was their actions that facilitated this display of glory. And with that came a knowledge that was unique to them. An insight that was uniquely theirs to own, and all because they partnered with the voice and the activity of Jesus and served his agenda. Do you know, there is a unique knowledge of God that is given to the servants of God, to those who steward his glory. When we begin to carry and facilitate his glory, there is a unique revelation of him, a unique knowledge that he gives just to those who step out in obedience to him and serve him. Let me bring this to close. The final thing that we recognize is that in this miracle, you'll notice Jesus neither touches the water nor the wine at any point. This whole manifestation of glory took place at the hands of the servants. In fact, this manifestation of glory took place behind the scenes, backstage, behind the curtain. And these nameless, faceless servants served the agenda of Jesus in the secret, private, intimate place. And in doing so, they facilitated glory within a moment. They drew the wine. They took it to the master of the banquet. They carried something of his glory from the intimate presence of Jesus to those in their vicinity. These servants embodied exactly what we want to be and what we're called to be. Stewards of glory. Those that facilitate and carry his glory. Here is a picture of what I think it is that God is calling Glasgow Elam to be. Our gatherings are to be the behind-the-scenes curtain moment where we gather to steward, to serve his will and his agenda, to hear his voice, to embody his agenda, to partner with his activity and to be moved and shaped by him. We are to gather to carry his glory and to host his glory to those in our vicinity and those around us. This call to be stewards of glory is a call to facilitate and carry his glory. It's not just to have holy parties in his house. It's not just to have great services filled with the fullness of God and transforming us in here, but with no bearing on those out there. We are to facilitate his glory in our gatherings, but then carry his glory in our goings. And I think that's significant, so I'm going to say it again. We are to facilitate his glory in our gatherings, but carry his glory in our goings. This place is to be like a revolving door. We come to serve Jesus, hear his voice, embody his ministry, and then leave to carry his glory to those around us, to our communities, our city, and beyond. And all of that starts by serving the voice and the agenda of God. We must listen and do and listen, because that is what moves us from being the servants of festivities to stewards of his glory. It's possibly a poor analogy, but I think it's the gauntlet, the challenge, the invitation that's put down before us. We can continue to serve these festivities, and Jesus has no problem with that. He turned up at the wedding and hung out at the wedding. He enjoyed the festivities. We can continue to serve the festivities, or we can begin to steward glory. I don't know about you, but I just feel I'm at a stage of life where I want to see his glory. And I want to see my kids being raised and developing in their faith journey within an experience of glory. And I want to see your kids being raised within an experience and developing within the experience of glory. Church, we need to go after the glory of God. We need to become stewards. And that involves us committing. We're going to listen as well as we do, and we're going to do as well as we listen. We're going to step out in obedience. Even if we're not sure what the next step looks like, we're going to take this first step. And together we're going to host something significant of God in our generation and in our city. Amen.